Our goal is that the buyers recognize the importance and the comparative advantages of Alaska.
The Parnell administration touts Alaska gas in Asia. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, False Pass considers the enormous potential of tidal energy.
And if we can capture it in False Pass, then we can capture it all along the coast, all the way up.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The U.S. Department of the Interior announced it will hold a lease sale in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, in November. The lease sale will take place in Anchorage on Wednesday, November 7th. Companies will be able to bid for drilling access to 4.5 million acres of land. Last month, the Department of Interior announced its plan for drilling in the NPRA. The entire Alaska congressional delegation slammed the proposal, saying it locked up 23 million acres from development. This will be the second lease sale in the reserve in 2 years. The sale will take place one day after the election. The announcement will allow the Obama campaign to further tout its all-of-the-above energy strategy. The president and Democrats have taken heat for not encouraging enough oil and gas drilling on federal lands. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell is in Japan today after leaving South Korea yesterday. He's pitching foreign governments on the state's potential to export liquefied natural gas. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The governor's trip follows Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan's own jaunt. He visited Korea and Japan. While there, Sullivan says he met with executives from Exxon and BP, two companies that could potentially tap natural gas in the North Slope and build the required pipeline to move it. He says those companies have projects and customers across the globe, and he's hoping they'll share his message that investing in Alaska's LNG is a stable option for the long term.
Our goal is when they're having discussions with these companies and buyers, that the buyers recognize the importance and the comparative advantages of Alaska. So when they have discussions, they ask for Alaska gas, not just any gas.
Not just any gas from Qatar or even the lower 48. Sullivan says he emphasizes that, unlike gas from the rest of the states, Alaska's gas will not have to contend with the debate surrounding fracking. Earlier this year, Governor Parnell requested a proposal from the three companies that would build an LNG pipeline. It's due out at the end of the month. Larry Persily, the federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, says the trips to Asia will not spur the companies to move any quicker, but they're good for business, and the bottom line still matters most.
We still have to compete on price. There are a lot of other projects around the world trying to sell the same quality of molecules of natural gas into the same markets, and Alaska is going to have to be price competitive or we're not going to get there.
So far, Persily says, the companies have not seen a multi-billion dollar pipeline as worth the investment, and it's unlikely they do until there's a willing buyer overseas. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The tiny Aleutian village of False Pass is about to become a lab for cutting-edge renewable energy. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, if the experiment works, False Pass will be the first town in the country to be powered by ocean currents.
A few years back, a handful of community leaders from all across the Bering Sea met up to talk energy. The top priority? To get away from expensive diesel once and for all. Bruce Wright, a scientist for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, or APIA, was at the table.
One particularly big goal was to reduce our fossil fuel usage by 80%. Another objective that came out of that was to get a renewable energy project into every Aleut community.
Wright's job is to investigate renewable energy sources throughout the Aleutians. Now, he wants to see if ocean turbines can use currents to power the 37-person town of False Pass, kind of how wind turbines are used on land. Alaska has an insanely strong current system, but it's never been harnessed. A recent Department of Energy report determined that the state's waters could power every house west of the Mississippi River, and then some.
That water that is moving in this stream, this Alaska coastal current, is moving towards the Arctic Ocean. And so the first place it cuts through the Aleutian Islands is False Pass. So I thought maybe there's an ocean current project, that study that we could do there. Maybe there's a potential for producing ocean energy using ocean current.
Not only is Wright working with a great location, he's got good timing. The DOE is aggressively pursuing ocean energy projects to meet the country's clean energy goals. That's why they're investing $200,000 in a tribal energy grant to study the currents at False Pass. At the end of this month, Wright and a team of researchers will use that money to set up a temporary floating lab on a halibut longliner. They'll be looking for sweet spots where water speeds are at least 5 miles per hour. They'll also be trying to figure out what type of water turbine could work best with the environment.
The one that I'm really interested in is the one that doesn't kill fish and marine mammals for obvious reasons. So this is a horizontal axis turbine that runs at low speeds, so it doesn't turn very fast. And from the video footage I've seen, fish seem to avoid it, and they can even swim through it without getting killed.
It's too early to say how much money it would take to move False Pass to all ocean power. But if they made the transition, the town wouldn't have to worry about rising oil costs anymore. And once Wright's team can figure out how to power False Pass, he says other Alaskan communities could start harvesting ocean current too.
And if we can capture it in False Pass, then we can capture it all along the coast, all the way up. So, you know, this could be the first of 500 power plants all along the coast.
And if the project works out and the DOE's projections are right, that would provide more energy than Alaska's communities would even know what to do with. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Need a bridge? It's not the usual thing to see in the classifieds, but the state of Alaska wants to unload the 47-year-old Brotherhood Bridge, which spans Juneau's Mendenhall River. Federal law requires the State Department of Transportation preserve historic bridges if possible, says Jane Gendron, environmental manager for the Southeast region.
You can't re-engineer or keep that bridge in place, you reach out and find other interested parties who would be able to remove the bridge and reassemble it to preserve its historic nature in some other location. That is a requirement as part of our federal funding for a bridge replacement project.
Brotherhood Bridge was designed by Alaska Native leader Roy Paradovich Jr. for the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. The bridge was dedicated on Alaska Day in 1965. The new bridge will be built next year to accommodate 4 lanes of traffic, a multi-use path on one side and sidewalk on the other. Beyond that, there are few details, says DOT Chief Bridge Engineer Rich Pratt. He says bridge designers are waiting for highway engineers to finalize roadway specifications.
Start with the road, you know, how wide do the road guys want the road and what's the alignment look like, and then we'll make the bridge match the road, because it's very rare for the bridge to control anything.
Pratt says the 319-foot-long, 30-foot-wide, reinforced concrete and steel Brotherhood Bridge is unremarkable, except for special bronze medallions representing the crest of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. He says they will be removed and preserved. Like most old bridges, Brotherhood Bridge has been painted with lead-based paint. Pratt says DOT is responsible for removing all the paint before it's sold, if it ever is.
Not uncommon that no one wants these old bridges, and then what happens is we document what's out there, all that's filed away through the historic people, and we send the bridge out to be recycled.
Brotherhood Bridge is eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. If someone decides to preserve it, they will have to remove it. DOT has set no price. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an historian makes an unusual find combing through some of the first maps of Alaska.
Had no idea what it was, but it was like nothing else I'd ever seen in the archives.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Medical examiners are working to identify a body found near the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail in Anchorage yesterday. Anchorage Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says a person using the trail spotted the body in a heavily wooded area between the paved trail and Cook Inlet just before 3 p.m. yesterday afternoon. The APD closed a 200-yard portion of the trail east of Postmark Drive to investigate into the night. Officials say the body is badly decomposed. They cannot identify the gender, and dental records are being used to make an ID. Parker says the investigation is ongoing and the medical ID could take some time. The Alaska Railroad is planning to resume freight traffic between Anchorage and Fairbanks today after repairs were made to 500 feet of track washed out by flooding. Railroad officials in a release say crews working double shifts have repaired the track near Gold Creek, about 35 miles north of Talkeetna. Trains between Anchorage and Fairbanks have not operated since September 19th. That means no tank cars carrying petroleum from the North Pole Refinery or coal cars from Usabelli Coal Mines at Healy, north of Denali National Park. The railroad has put the cost estimate to repair damage system-wide from flooding and storms at nearly $2 million. Officials later this week expect to add to that lost revenue from interrupted train deliveries and say it's expected to be a substantial amount. Scientists can't predict earthquakes yet, but the United States Geological Survey has been piloting a system in California for a year that gives early warning before an earthquake hits. The federal agency will update Congress on how it's working later this week. Elizabeth Cochran is a USGS seismologist. She says the agency has been working on developing an earthquake early warning system for a long time.
In this case, what we're doing is we're actually have our sensors hopefully very close to where the earthquake starts. And using information from those few sensors nearby, we can quickly estimate where the earthquake is, how big it is, and then use the fact that information travels faster over the internet and over phone lines than the seismic wave travels. So we can get that warning out ahead of the seismic waves to tell people that strong shaking is coming their way.
How much warning? You said that it's not a way to predict earthquakes, but how much warning can you get in advance of the actual event?
So we're really talking about seconds to tens of seconds of warning. The example we use here in California, which is where this system is really being piloted, is for an earthquake that occurs on the southern part of the San Andreas Fault. Here in L.A., we would get about 60 seconds of warning before strong shaking arrived.
How helpful is it if it only gives users seconds to react before an earthquake hits?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the obvious question, right? What are you going to do with 10 seconds, 20 seconds, up to 60 seconds of warning? But you have to think of all of the various uses. So a lot of the things can actually be automated. So, for example, if you have a train system, what you can do is slow and stop that train automatically before the shaking gets there, hopefully preventing derailments. One of the examples we love to give is if you're going to have dental work done. You know, the dentist is coming at you with the drill. Maybe they could pull back for a few seconds, pull back quickly with those few seconds of warning. So very basic things like that. And then for the general population, things like getting under a sturdy desk or away from potentially dangerous objects that could fall on them would all be reasonable actions to take in a few seconds.
Elizabeth, do you think this could be expanded to Alaska?
There's certainly no essentially scientific reason why it can't be expanded to Alaska. Most of the reason that it's currently being developed in California right now is we have a very nice, dense seismic network. And that's mostly due to the fact that we have a pretty high population as well as relatively high seismic risk. The next place that the early warning system is planned for development is actually in the Washington State region, which would be much more analogous in terms of the actual tectonic boundary as what you have up in Alaska. So essentially, if the seismic network is built up to the point where we can get this information very quickly, then there's no reason that we can't do this in Alaska as well.
Why is it so difficult to predict earthquakes?
One of the main reasons is we have very little information about what's going on at the depths at which earthquakes occur. So it's I always like to give the analogy to weather, meteorology. So the meteorologists have a huge amount of information about the temperature, pressure, wind speeds, all of that throughout the atmosphere. And from that, they have models they can run and predict what, you know, is today going to be hot and sunny or cold and rainy. We have a very difficult problem with earthquakes because we're trying to do all of that underground. So there's no instrumentation, there's no way of actually getting the information we need from those depths.
Elizabeth Cochran is a seismologist for USGS who is working to develop the earthquake early warning system.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. A fall can cause traumatic brain injury and require follow-up care outside of your home community. To help prevent falls, eat foods that are rich in calcium and vitamin D, like fish head soup and kelp with herring eggs. Be active, walk often, participate in subsistence activities, and have your vision checked at least once a year. More information at anthc.org. This message sponsored by the ANTHC Injury Prevention Program.
A report that could change the way cruise ships handle wastewater is nearly done. A state science advisory panel met last week in Juneau and shared some of its work with the public. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska's Cruise Ship Science Advisory Panel has spent about 2 years looking at options for cleaning up wastewater. That includes discharges of harmful bacteria, dissolved metals, and other pollutants. Some ships already use systems that can meet elevated standards. Some do not, while others only discharge outside state enforcement boundaries. The 11-member panel finished its work on a preliminary report during its Juneau meeting, but the document still must undergo review. Division of Water Deputy Director Andrew Sayers-Fay says he hopes it's available to the public by November 1st. State Cruise Ship Program Manager Rob Edwardson says it's an important step in a process started by the legislature in 2009.
The Science Advisory Panel is using the preliminary report as a tool to assist and advise the commissioner on his report to the legislature that's due January 1st of 2013.
A technology open house that was part of the science panel meeting presented the history of cruise ships in Alaska and current water quality issues. Edwardson says one is exploration of current cruise ship systems.
The second is the availability of additional methods that are economically feasible and technologically effective. And the third is the environmental cost and benefit of implementing any additional methods that they may find.
The feasibility issue is part of the legislature's charge to the panel. That led to examination of water cleaning systems not yet used on the ships. Sitka's Steve Reifenstuhl represents the United Fishermen of Alaska on the science panel.
We have looked at technology that it's used in land-based facilities. There isn't technology that has been used on cruise ships that can do that at this point. That's not to say that it's not feasible in the future. at a very high cost.
Higher standards were called for in a 2006 cruise ship initiative approved by voters, which also created a passenger head tax. The panel was established as part of a compromise that delayed full enforcement. Cruise lines argued the standards could be met by allowing discharges to be diluted through mixing zones. Basically, that meant sampling water a distance from the ship rather than from the discharge pipe itself. Seattle environmental compliance analyst Lincoln Lohr represents the industry on the panel. He says water cleaning systems in use now are about as good as it gets.
I don't see that there's convincing information on the effectiveness of these additional add-ons to consistently meet the water quality criteria at the end of the pipe.
Mixing zones or other forms of dilution are methods opposed by clean water activists. Reifenstuhl, who holds the panel's fishing industry seat, says he's optimistic about the final results.
The goal is to protect Alaska's waters, and I think that the science panel is going to come out with a report that will do that.
The panel's report to the legislature is formally a preliminary document, but it's unclear what might change between its release and the deadline for a final report 2 years in the future. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Every once in a while, an historian makes a find that changes everything. Recently, a researcher combing through the National Archives made just such a discovery. In this case, while working on a project to scan some of the very first maps of Alaska, he learned how early cartographers so accurately depicted places they had never been. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
John Cloud works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Washington, D.C., and despite his made-to-order name, is not in the National Weather Service. He's a contract historian who says the luckiest assignment he ever took was digging into the National Archives 7 years ago to retrieve early maps of Alaska made by the Coast Survey, the progenitor of NOAA.
You know, there was all these patterns that emerged about Alaska mapping. And the Coast Survey was really critical to the entire invention of Alaska and the purchase of Russian America.
The patterns Cloud's talking about refer to the level of detail in the Coast Survey maps of a place Americans really didn't know that much about. In fact, those first maps don't even call it Alaska. They're labeled Northwestern America. Then he found it.
I had no idea what it was, but it was like nothing else I'd ever seen in the archives.
It was a set of pencil and paper drawings, a mosaic of sorts, that together formed a map drawn by a Klukwan Klingit. At the time, Cloud did not understand his luck.
I will say I have a good eye, and I scanned a lot of things that I didn't know anything about, but as soon as I saw them, I thought they were interesting. And these included stumbling upon the incredible map done by Shotridge and his two wives for George Davidson in 1869 at Klukwan up the Chilkat River, and the five maps drawn by the Inupiat Joe Kokaryuk in 1898 for the Coast and Geodetic Survey in the Lower Yukon Delta.
Two native mapmakers, a generation apart, provided the Coast Survey with information on thousands of miles of river and coastline. The Klingit Kokluk, better known as Shotridge, and the Inupiat Joe Kokaryuk. Their stories have some parallels, so to speak. In 1867, George Davidson ran the Coast Survey on the West Coast out of an office in San Francisco. If you compare the map his agency produced for the transfer of Alaska in 1867 against the map made by the same office only 2 years later, the new detail in the Northern Panhandle is extraordinary. John Cloud says the cartographers of the Coast Survey were scientists first and foremost, and that they often sought out indigenous sources to fill in critical detail in their maps. The Klingit, however, are characterized by a rich protocol surrounding intellectual property rights. The kind of information Davidson needed was really not available for the asking, but it could be exchanged. By coincidence, Davidson learned that a solar eclipse would be visible in southeast Alaska in 1869, with the track of the full eclipse plotted right through Klukwan. Davidson steamed north to await the eclipse and observed it through a modified telescope with Shotridge. This was the breakthrough that cartographers were waiting for.
And in the aftermath of that eclipse, there was this intellectual potlatch where Davidson made a painting of the eclipse as he'd seen it at totality in his special telescope. Shotridge and his two wives made a series of maps of the geography up and over the mountains, the ancient trade routes of the Tlingit, all the way over and down to the main stem of the Yukon River. And then the two parties exchanged the painting of the eclipse and the map.
So the 1869 Shotridge map was one of Cloud's discoveries in the archives, as was the map of Alaska's far north coast drawn 30 years later by Joe Kekariuk. Cloud wondered, and you may be thinking by now, how did they do it? How does someone with no training in cartography, no training in using pencil and paper for that matter, produce a map so accurate that it's incorporated into the official records of a nation?
That's the whole question. Where is the map? Is the map the thing that's put down on paper, or is the map what's in your head in the first place that is then presented on paper, or is sketched in a mud bank? In the case of Joe Kekariuk, that's how they noticed that he was making little sketch maps on a mud bank for other Eskimos. He was the interpreter and expediter of the Coast Survey Party on the lower Yukon Delta. And, you know, they could see that he was good at it. And so they said, hey, how about we give you some paper and a pencil, literally. So very much exactly the same situation a generation later, Shotridge and his wives. But again, the map, in both cases, if it hadn't been in their heads in the first place, how could they have possibly put it down on paper?
Locating the original map sets by Shotridge and Joe Kekariuk was a great find of many John Cloud made while searching the National Archives. But one mystery remains. So much of Alaska was open to view because an early mapmaker, George Davidson, followed an eclipse and made a painting of it, which he mounted on the back of a Chilkat blanket pattern board. A copy survives in San Francisco, but the original has never been found. John Cloud is not discouraged.
All you have to do is just go around the world, wherever there are Chilkat Indian pattern boards, and turn them over, because they only used them on one side. And if you turn over enough of them, you'll finally turn one over, and there will be the eclipse painting.
And that may be your aha moment. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Falls Pass, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Ladders are simple and effective tools in the workplace, but every year, thousands of employees are seriously injured or killed falling from ladders. Training to avoid improper ladder use can save lives. Employers for no-cost safety and health consultation and training services, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.